This is Focus West Michigan for Wednesday, February 11, 2026. I'm Joe Bilecki with your local news. The Grand Rapids Board of Education has selected four candidates to interview for the vacant board trustee position. WGVU's David Limbaugh has the details.
Former trustee Eric Davis resigned from the Board of Education on January 23rd. According to policy, the board has 30 days to appoint a new member. Four candidates were selected from 20 applications. They are Robert Hovenkamp, Ismalis Nunez, Raynard Ross, and Erica Van Dyke. Interviews will take place during a Board of Education special meeting on Wednesday, February 18th at 6 p.m. at GRPS University on Fuller Avenue. The meeting is open to the public, and the board is expected to vote for one of the four candidates. That trustee will serve through December 31st, 2026, at which time an elected member will complete the remaining 2 years of the term. I'm David Limbaugh.
A former Caledonia Elementary School is getting a new life as a career prep center. WGVU's Dee Morrison has the details.
The Caledonia Board of Education has officially approved a purchase agreement to sell the former Dutton Elementary School in Gaines Township to the Kent Intermediate School District. The ISD plans to build its second Career and Technical Education Center on the property. Its first center in Grand Rapids offers programs in engineering, manufacturing, industrial technology, business, arts, and health sciences to 2,500 current students. The expansion will benefit Caledonia students with specialized career training and technical learning opportunities much closer to home. A new Dutton Elementary opened last year on Patterson Avenue. Superintendent Dirk Wheeldryer noted, while the goodbye is bittersweet, the district is pleased the site will continue to serve as a hub for student development. Residents have a final chance to tour the building, reflect on memories, and see the space one last time at an open house Tuesday, February 24th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. I'm Dee Morrison.
When they started charging people to park at the beach a few years ago, some Muskegon leaders were afraid people would stop coming, but WGVU's Phil Dawson reports just the opposite has happened.
Despite the paid parking, there was a very significant increase in visits from 2019 to 2025.
When Muskegon started paid parking at city beaches in 2019, Director of Development Jake Eckholm says some expected a drop in attendance. But maybe because of all the parking fee publicity, he says the number of visitors is up.
Paid parking has actually drawn more visitorship because of the emphasis on our parking system.
Before paid parking, City Manager Jonathan Seifert says beach operations cost Muskegon $500,000 a year.
And one of the objectives of having parking fees at the beach was to cover those costs.
Last year, Seifert says beach parking revenues totaled almost $1.4 million. More than enough to cover the now $1.1 million in expenses.
We're bringing in more through parking revenue than we're spending out at the beach.
Beach parking is currently $10 on weekdays, $16 on weekends, and $40 for a season pass.
More and more people from outside the Muskegon metro area starting to find their way here, utilizing that paid parking system and providing revenue for our general fund.
I'm Phil Dawson.
There's a warning out to residents about using and buying unregistered pesticides containing certain ingredients. WGVU's Jennifer Moss has more.
The warning comes from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services and the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development. And officials say residents should avoid purchasing unregistered pesticides containing dichlorvos or DDVP, and it includes the brand name Sniper and No Pest. A news release from MDARD says despite their potentially harmful health effects, Sniper and No Pest remain available for purchase via online marketplaces, where they are marketed as insecticides for home use. These and other pesticides that contain highly concentrated DDVP are responsible, they say, for recent poisonings in Michigan. Consumers should be aware that not all pesticides purchased online are registered by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency or are safe to use at home. MDAR Director Tim Boring says, quote, "These recent cases are a serious reminder that unregistered or illegal pesticide products can pose significant risk to public health," end quote. Officials say if you do become sick after being exposed to pesticides, contact poison control or call 911 if you become severely ill. I'm Jennifer Moss.
Ottawa County's Park Township is one step closer to finalizing the purchase of Holland's decommissioned Coast Guard Station. WGVU's David Limbaugh has the details.
Since May 2025, Park Township has made attempts to purchase Holland's Coast Guard Station, which closed in 2022. At that time, township officials were requesting $600,000 in state funding to purchase the facility to complement its two fire stations on the north and south side of Lake Makatawa. It would serve as a base for the fire department's water rescue operations. State funding was granted, and money from the American Rescue Plan Act makes up the rest of the $1.4 million total. This week, township officials announced they have signed an offer to purchase with the U.S. government for the transfer of ownership from the Coast Guard to Park Township, which could take ownership of the facility by the end of February. In a statement, Park Township Fire Chief Scott Gamby wrote, quote, "The department took to the waters of Lake Makatawa last fall and have used the wave runners to rescue people in distress in the waters of Lake Mack, the Channel, and Lake Michigan. We will be able to do more with the Coast Guard station as our base of operations," end quote. The location offers a 5-minute emergency response time to Holland State Park. I'm David Limbaugh.
Coming up soon, another one of StoryCorps' One Small Step conversations, but first, news from around the state. Reactions to President Donald Trump's threats to delay the opening of the new border crossing between Detroit and Windsor, Ontario, are starting to fall along party lines. As Colin Jackson reports, the White House says Trump wants to renegotiate the bridge agreement.
The Gordie Howe International Bridge is scheduled to open this year, but Trump could try to delay it after claiming it'd be unfair to the U.S. Governor Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat, says she's been talking with people in power to get Trump to change his mind. She says it would help the state's economy.
I don't want to put too much onto those conversations until I speak directly with the president, but we are having a lot of conversations at the staff level, at the administration level.
But Republican House Speaker Matt Hall says he's supporting Trump's threats as a negotiation tactic in Canadian trade talks.
President Trump is on the right leverage point to get Canada to the table.
Canada is paying for the new bridge and will share ownership with Michigan. I'm Colin Jackson in Lansing.
The governor signed a ban on smartphones in Michigan classrooms into law on Tuesday. The law creates a base-level statewide policy for districts to follow when it comes to handling phones in schools. Some Michigan school systems have already put similar plans in place or gone farther. Carcia Young is a math teacher at Waverly High School near Lansing. She says keeping phones out of school has made a big difference for her students.
When students are fully present, they participate more, retain more, and achieve more. This is not about punishment or taking something away. It's about protecting the learning environment so students can focus on what matters most.
Many other states, including Indiana and Ohio, have their own policies to restrict cell phone use in school. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission held a public meeting on Monday to get more details on repairs to help reopen the Palisades nuclear plant in southwest Michigan. The company Holtec International told regulators on Monday it can't find safety testing documentation behind welding done on three components. Jay Collins is with the NRC. He says the company will have to show other similar materials that the welding was safe.
But the actual testing that they're going to do to verify this through analysis of their own materials as well as looking for other materials that might be available, we're going to want in-depth information on that.
Holtec originally said it planned to restart Palisades by the end of last year. Now the company says the restart will happen only after all the work is done and all regulations have been met. Focus West Michigan is brought to you by listeners like you. To support the show and everything we do here, visit WGVUnews.org and click the donate button. And for a weekly dose of news right to your inbox, sign up for the WGVU newsletter. Today in our One Small Step conversation, we bring together two strangers for a conversation about their lives, not politics. Despite coming from very different family backgrounds and spiritual paths, Jane and Becky discover they share a strong commitment to social justice.
Hi, my name is Jane. I am 71 years old. I am from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hi, my name is Becky. I'm 68 years old, and I am from Allendale, Michigan. I grew up mostly in the Lansing area. most of my friends, people I interacted with, their parents were either auto workers at General Motors. Some of them were executives. Some of them worked on the line and or also workers in state government. It was really a very mixed group of people that I went to school with, that I was friends with, even racially mixed at that time, which I think was somewhat unusual. And so I'm very grateful because it really laid a good foundation for being able to go out into the world and realize that there are many perspectives out there and that everybody's experience of life is not the same as mine.
Well, it sounds like you were lucky that way. What was your family like?
At the time, you know, the mid-60s, a traditional middle-class family. My mom didn't work. My dad did. We were not wealthy when I was younger. My dad did do very well in business later on. And so I think we were probably what was considered upper middle class, but we didn't live that way. We had a very small house. We had one bathroom. We had one car. You know, we didn't have a lot of the things that a lot of other people have. And I just assumed that was normal, but it wasn't. A lot of my friends had things. My parents didn't value that at all. I'm grateful for that too, because that was a perspective I got where the outward appearances are not what matter. It's really what's in a person. And my parents are not particularly what I would call religious at all, but I did pick up that value from them. And my faith is very important to me. They laid the groundwork for really a values-based life, and I'm grateful for that.
You have siblings?
Nope, I'm an only child.
You're an only child. I grew up in a Detroit suburb. As you noted about Lansing, very heavily automotive. Friends' dads worked in the different companies. And I distinctly remember at one point, one of the schools had a fair. And one of the most popular things at the fair was smashing a Toyota. So I grew up in the 50s, 60s, early 70s in a subdivision of 48 homes, and everybody was Catholic. There are four kids in my family. I'm in the middle. I have an older sister, and then I have a younger sister and brother who are twins. And my upbringing was very strict Catholic. We said the family rosary in the month of May and the month of October after dinner. We had to go to church. I am no longer a practicing Catholic, and that's probably why, because I felt that we were brainwashed. I would call it an upper middle class existence. My parents, especially my mom, always wanted more than they could afford. And unlike your parents, appearances were very important, especially to my mother. I went to a Catholic girls' high school, and then I went to a Catholic college for about a year and a half before transferring as a result of a race incident that was very unpleasant and very unfortunate. Unlike you, I did not grow up in any kind of a diverse place at all. Everybody was white. Everybody was Catholic. Everybody had a lot of kids. The one thing I can say that was really important that was like deal breaker for me was realizing when I was about 16 or 17 that a woman was not good enough to become a priest, to be Christ-like. So I was out. When I transferred to U of M, suddenly I was free to do what I wanted to do. That was the end of that. I've changed careers at least three times. I graduated from art school I started out working in advertising and graphic design. And then I migrated to being a writer. And after I had my first child, that first year was really hard. I got myself into a position of creative director at the ad agency where I worked. And I lost my ambition as soon as I had that baby boy. So I left and I went freelance, and I did really well as a freelance writer. But then when I started to hit my mid late 30s and I had another child, I got kind of bored with what I was writing. So I went through some counseling out at Grand Valley, and counselor said, have you ever thought about going to law school? So I ended up going back to law school in sort of midlife. After that, I practiced law for about 7-8 years. And then I got recruited by my law school to teach an intro course. And then I ended up teaching legal writing and research for about 12 years.
That's quite a diverse portfolio of things you've done there.
Yeah, truck driving might be next. I always wanted to drive a big rig.
I ran for county commissioner in Ottawa County to represent Allendale, which is a heavily Republican area. And, you know, I was actually encouraged when I was considering a run to not even run as a Democrat, to run as a Republican, which that's how unlikely it was for somebody running as a Democrat to be able to win. My values align with the Democratic Party, so there's no way that I would run as a Republican. But even if I were to try to do that as some kind of way of getting political traction, people would look at that and think that I was being dishonest, and I certainly would have been. So that was not going to happen. When I ran, I actually made some huge inroads. I got 40% of the vote, which was, a lot for this area as running as a Dem. That's never happened before. And I worked really hard to do that. I walked, part of it's rural, but part of it is developed. And so in those developed areas, I walked every neighborhood, knocked every door, talked to everybody who would listen, and got a lot of positive feedback.
Did you have the opportunity to talk to people who were Republican?
I got maybe just a handful of people that did not want to talk to me when they found out who I was. I mean, literally like five at the most. I knocked on, I would say, at least 6,000 doors during this campaign. So very small number. And I got a huge number of people when I explained who I was who said, I've never voted for a Democrat before in my life, but I'm going to vote for you. Not because I'm all that, but because they were concerned about what was happening in Ottawa County. I'm not glad about the outcome, but I'm glad I did it. So the other piece of that is my Christian faith. From my viewpoint, the two important things about Christianity are to love God with all your heart and soul, and then to love others as yourself. Neither one of those is optional. And so when I look at political platforms, I look at, in my opinion, which of the parties is doing the work that number two calls us to do, which is to love others as ourselves. And I see that in the Democratic Party, and specifically in ways that are controversial, like how to advocate for undocumented immigrants. That definitely puts me at odds with people, and I talk to a lot of them regularly around here, who think that undocumented immigrants are breaking the law and they just need to go back where they came from. That is true that some of them might be breaking the law, but I also think that immigration law is a relatively recent construct and that none of us would be here had our ancestors had to contend with that. All of that is just is an example of how I think government policy for so many years, in my opinion, has stood in the way of those in the margin. And it's not a case of giving handouts. It's just being mindful of the fact that government can make or break someone on the margins in terms of their ability to thrive and survive. And I feel very strongly that it needs to do that.
I completely agree with you on some things, and on others I don't, which would be pretty normal. And I completely agree with feeling a moral obligation to help those who are less fortunate than we are. I can't do the God thing. Some days wish I did have that kind of a faith. But I don't. I admire those who have it, but I think that I'm still trying to live a good life because those values were instilled in me like they were in you, whether you call it Catholic or Christian or Jewish or Muslim or whatever. I don't really care. It's valuing humanity.
I will just say the people that I'm most admiring of are the people who either are not Christians, have no faith at all, or people who did belong to a Christian faith of some type and decided to leave it. And they're very intentional about what they're doing and why they're doing it. It's not just a pie in the sky kind of a abstract thing. I mean, they feel strongly that they also have an obligation to help remove barriers for people. I will count hundreds of them among my closest friends, probably more so than people that I know from church.
When I was 18, living in Birmingham, northwest all-white suburb of Detroit, busing was a huge thing. Everybody was concerned that their white kids would be bused to black schools and that black kids would be bused into our lily white schools. Running as a Democratic precinct delegate, there wasn't a hope in hell for me to win that one on that issue. And I remember standing outside 100 feet from the polling place and having men who I knew walk by me and go, I'm not voting for you, but I admire your guts. That was my first foray into politics. If you could talk to a younger version of yourself, what would you say?
Don't be afraid to be yourself. Don't be looking over your shoulder or wondering what anybody's going to think or whatever. I still have to tell myself that, but I would tell myself earlier than I've told myself that.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to wear that. Don't be afraid to do that. Don't be afraid to say that. Don't be afraid to try that. Just do it. Do it all.
I have said this to that younger version of myself. I feel really sorry for her. She tried really hard. She tried really hard to please her mother, mainly, to be good. I want to say to her, nothing you ever did was bad. As a child and a teenager, I felt like I was so bad because I, you know, wasn't the person that my mother wanted me to be. She was probably the biggest influence in my life, good and bad. I feel sorry for my younger self. She really tried hard. And I'd really like to tell her now, you know, you should have like just let it all go. What's something that you will take with you, Becky, from this experience?
I would like to have you as a friend. That's what I would take from this experience.
Oh, that's really sweet. I'm really glad that you are in this world.
This has been Focus West Michigan from WGVU for Wednesday, February 11, 2026. I'm Joe Bilecki. Our audio operations manager is Rick Bierling, and our news and public affairs director is Patrick Center. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll be back with more news and events in West Michigan tomorrow. Thanks for listening.